Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have with us our good friend, Mr. Sean Palmer. Sean.
Ready for some awesome.
Now Storm has infected you with that introduction, hasn't he?
Every time I think of you, I think I need to
get ready for some awesome. Yeah. Well, that's very, very sweet of you. Now, truth be told, you were the very first guest on the Newsworthy with Norisworthy podcast.
So I know. I'm honored to be back like that. I'm competing with Richard Beck. I think I want to have my life's ambition is to have more appearances on the podcast than Richard Beck. But the problem is he's so much smarter and more interesting than I am.
And better hair.
And better hair.
He does have better hair, yeah.
I think he's slightly taller than me, too, which...
You're both overly tall. There's no reason to be as tall as both of you guys are.
He's not overly tall.
Yeah, overly... Once you get over 5'11", it's just excessive. Like, we now have ladders and high-heel shoes. There's no reason to be that tall. It's a waste of height.
Well, for some strange reason, the people who built my house put the smoke detectors in the ceiling, and we have very high ceilings. And I have to get in, like, on a ladder to change out the smoke detector. And every time I have to do that, I'm thinking, I am not overly tall.
So, yeah, okay, well, whatever.
On the flip side, every time I have to fly coach, which is every time I fly, I think I'm overly tall.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Now, for you to make the time to come talk to me today is a big deal, because I know that we're recording this on the day that Serial's finale was.
Serial finale was today.
You might be the biggest advocate I know of the Serial podcast.
Well, I don't know who you know, so that may be true. So I don't know everybody that you know.
Well, there seems to be, obviously it's like one of the top five most popular podcasts on iTunes, if not the top.
Well, here's the thing. I do consider myself kind of a cultural curator for.
Oh, wow. cultural curator.
But yeah, the podcasts I talk most about are Serial and Newsworthy.
You know what's crazy is I'm obviously a fan of podcasts in general, and I listened to the very first episode of Serial because it was on
This America.
Yeah, and so I didn't have a choice. I just showed, oh, okay, I'll check it out. I listened to the first two. I think even texted you about it because you had tweeted or Facebooked or something, and I said, I can't do
at
it.
At Sean Palmer, SeanPalmer, for yeah. Those listening in.
Gosh.
If anyone besides my mother is listening.
Always be promoting. Clothing. I like that. Right. Yeah. Yeah. But I couldn't do it. I listened to it with my brother-in-law on a road trip. We caught up, you know, 3, 4, 5 episodes and I checked out. So did he do it or not?
Did he do it or not?
Yeah.
I don't know.
See, why would you listen to how many episodes? 12 episodes?
12 episodes.
And
I wasn't there, so there's no way that I can know.
You spent 12 hours of your – the reason I like Radiolab, it's one of my favorite podcasts, mm-hmm. is you have an hour. They introduce you to a subject. They give you some information about it. There's some conclusion. The conclusion might be ambiguous. Obviously, like Serial's ambiguous, but you at least know what you're getting into. Serial, 12 hours of your life, you still don't know anything.
Well – you asked me, did he do it? You didn't ask me if I think he's guilty.
Oh gosh. Now you sound like that reporter. Well, my sources say, and we're not, okay, whatever. All right.
It's just like your interview with Barbara Brown Taylor. Like there's knowing because I was there. I was a part of it. There's that kind of knowing. And then I think everybody in the story is lying. And that's what makes it ambiguous.
Yeah.
I don't think if I were on the jury, I'll tell you what it has done. And we could talk about Serial all day, but anyway,
no.
I think what it has done,
we can't.
I will be much less inclined. And I think we should all be, I'll be much less inclined to try and get out of jury duty.
Yeah. You said that. And that was interesting to me. Why are you more likely to show up for jury duty now?
Because like when I look at, just what's happened in the last year, I guess what we'll talk about a little bit with the Michael Brown deal and the New York, the Eric Garner strangling, and that I really do think, oh, yeah, we really need to have people, because you are busy and you want to get out of jury duty, mm-hmm. but I think we need busy people who are doing things, who are applying their life skills, who can put two and two together. Mm-hmm. Serving on our jury, I think our country is weakened when we have juries filled with people who just didn't have anything else to do.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Like, And like, what's the saying? Like juries are filled with 12 people who are too stupid to get out of jury duty.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did you see that movie, The Judge, with Robert Downey Jr.?
I haven't seen it yet, but I would like to.
So I really enjoyed that movie. And my brother-in-law, who was there with me, did not like it, but he's a terrible person. But it's a great – I really enjoyed it. But there's a scene in which Robert Downey Jr. is picking the jury members. And he has this line, and I don't remember the exact quote, but his basic point was, you want crazy people on there. People who you can easily convince whatever you want them to believe.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that about the – I'm not saying that's necessarily the case with the Michael Brown situation or the Eric Garner situation. I'm not saying, well, the decisions we got were because those people are stupid.
No, but think about it. Like, if you have 12 people and you get them in the room and you have two people who are really articulate and two very charismatic people, the entire nation is different – because you have people on a jury who are charismatic and who can influence their other jury members.
Yeah.
Isn't that crazy to think about how little that...
It's the 12 Angry Men effect. Have you seen the movie 12 Angry Men? I mean, one of my favorite movies, the old one, not the new one. The old one with Henry Fonda, not the new one with Jack Lemmon and the guy from The Sopranos. Whenever you put Tony Danza in a movie, I think that's a bad movie.
Oh, Tony the Tiger? No, but yeah, I saw the old one. And obviously there's... Yeah, very interesting.
So I think, there's actually a civic duty. I think anyone who's upset about, whether it goes back to the OJ case or whatever, if you're upset about what juries do, and then you work your best to get out of jury duty, I think that is an incoherent life system. And I think we should probably see jury duty as this is a civic responsibility, maybe the same way a lot of people see voting or paying their taxes on time and regularly. Say, we create this country together. Like, there's not a system that we're separate and apart from. And when you feel separated from the system, then you act out like a handful, I don't know how many, I know not all, like the Ferguson protesters did, like you smash up police cars and that sort of thing like that. That is a feeling of powerlessness in the system. And none of those people, given, you know, if the protesters were people who lived in Ferguson, were actually powerless. I mean, to have an all white or nearly all white police force in Ferguson, where that's where you live, or to have the police commissioner or police chief that you have and you don't like him when Ferguson has the African-American population that they have, That's a failure of people to go vote. Like, that's a failure to participate in the system. And so now you want to be mad at the system for not delivering what you wanted or what you thought or what you imagined was right. But this whole time you've been failing the system. So there's a certain aspect where the system that you failed to create is now failing you. And when we fail to create things, whether it's in our homes or in our churches, when we fail to create, then we end up with failed systems.
Yeah.
So anyway, so next time I get jury duty, I'm just going to go.
You're just going to go. You're not going to pretend like you've got to get your nails done or something. That's good.
Yeah, or, you know.
Do you think...
Which I'm getting my nails done tomorrow, by the way.
Well, it's good. You got to...
I have two little girls who are out of school, and we're
really
going to go get our nails done.
You're serious now, aren't you?
I'm dead serious.
Wow. I'm
dead serious.
There's a whole litany of questions that just popped in my head, but we're just going to leave it as it is.
I love my kids, and that's what they want to do.
Well, I love my daughters too. We both have daughters. You've got two. Yeah. I've got three.
But you've seen Frozen way more than I have.
No, I do.
So we all pay the price.
One way or the other. That's true. And I just want to build a snowman. So, you know, whatever. Let it go. Okay, so you reran a blog post this morning on your website. The Palmer Perspective, is it .com?
Yes.
.com. And it was on... What was the title on the Michael Brown piece?
It's Speaking of Michael Brown.
Okay, so you start off with the conversation that you and your buddy Jeff Brooks, right?
Jeff Brooks.
Yeah. So you and Jeff Brooks, you're bowling.
He was bowling, and a lady was talking...
Wait, were you not there?
I was not there.
Okay, well...
He was at the bowling alley.
You need to clear up your writing, because I thought you were. I feel like you deceived me.
it's called a close reading loop.
Okay, well, clearly it wasn't close reading when I read it. So he's there, and the lady next to him finds out he's a pastor, which is always an awkward conversation because you don't really want to say you're a pastor to most people, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, because it changes the conversation.
It ruins the conversation. All of a sudden, it's like, well, you know, my grandma goes to church, and I think it's really great, and she read a book once. Anyway, that happens, and she tells Jeff, you know, I hope you're a good one or something like that because my preacher talks about real stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. A good preacher talks about real stuff. Mm-hmm. True or false?
I think so. I think that's true.
Okay. So,
and I grew up in churches, and maybe you did too, where you walked in and the church experience inside the building with the group of people was completely divorced from life outside of the building.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked about kind of interesting topics, maybe to church people, and you heard 1,000 times about Paul's missionary journeys, but there was never a link inside what happened in the life of the church about how do we connect this teaching of Paul from Ephesians to what's actually happening in today's headlines.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that we do that are, like with Michael Brown, I was talking to my former youth minister the day before I wrote that, and he was saying that the church that he had visited the week before, that he would doubt that the issue with Michael Brown would even come up in the life of the church, though that's what everybody in a good chunk of the society was talking about.
Yeah, but to be fair, and I talked about this with Stormont the other day. It hasn't been posted yet, so I don't expect you to know this. But you get up there to preach. You want to speak into real circumstances, things that are really going on. And mm-hmm. you want to talk about Michael Brown. You want to talk about, you know, Trayvon Martin. You want to talk about whatever's going on. You want to talk about ISIS. But mm-hmm. the problem is, like, I wasn't trained to understand the judicial system. I wasn't trained to understand the intricacies of foreign policy. I wasn't trained to understand exactly how police forces work and understanding societal issues that are so complex that they're way above my pay grade. But I want to speak to that. But I'm likely just to speak out of my own experience mm-hmm. in such a way that it can divide the church, because hopefully if you're part of a good church, there are Republicans, there are Democrats, there are, you know, Tea Party, Green, no party, whatever. And you're going to speak out of your politics. Eventually it's going to seep into what you're saying, and you can in some ways do more damage. So maybe the person who isn't talking about it maybe is doing the better thing for the community. Possibly.
I think if you can't help but talk about your own, out of your own experience and your own politics, then you really shouldn't. Because there are enough Bill O'Reillys and enough Rachel Maddows in the world that we don't need to add to that. But here's the thing that I was trained in and you were trained in that you can speak out of. You can speak out of the life of Scripture. And so it's not like these things aren't foreign to the life of Jesus. Who should we pay taxes to? You know, Jesus, look at this coin and tell us. Well, Jesus has an answer for that. Jesus has an answer for how not we approach an issue of the day, but Jesus has an answer to how we approach politics as a whole. And so one of the things that we talked about just recently here, our first Sunday in Advent, is the incarnation. And what's at the heart of the incarnation is Jesus, you know, not just the 20,000 foot story of Jesus coming to earth and being born a baby of a virgin and having a life and teaching, and you know, saving people, which is all wonderful and good. And we talk about those things through the year. Okay. But what Jesus does in the incarnation is that he embraces the experience of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are a Hebrew, you have always understood God to be holy, the Holy One of Israel, who is separate and apart, and the rest of us are common. And Jesus actually becomes the thing that he is not. So I said at the end of that sermon, and because I do a lot of preaching biography, I said at the end of that sermon, because it was the week after Thanksgiving, we had gone to Houston to be with my wife's family, and her cousin Andy is a police officer in Houston. And he came, he was about to go on shift, and he shows up to Thanksgiving dinner in his uniform, vest on, he's got his sidearm and all that. He realized that there were lots of little kids in the house, I think, and he went someplace and took them off. But we had dinner because he's going to work. And I told the church that I have an experience having grown up in Mississippi and in Atlanta, Georgia, I have an experience that makes me more sympathetic to one side of these police arguments than I am to the other. Yeah. And I told them there's no use in us lying about that. And so do they. For whatever their experience is, they have an experience that makes them more sympathetic to the other. But then when Andy was leaving to go to work, that he did something that millions of husbands do every day when they go to work. He kissed his wife goodbye. They have three kids. They are our kids' cousins.
Yeah.
And for those of you listening in, my wife's Caucasian. I'm African American. And it dawned on me in that moment, like, it really is different when he goes to work than when I go to work.
Yeah.
And there's some measure whenever we leave to go anywhere, you get in a car or whatever, that you might not come back. There's a chance of a car wreck or whatever. But for him, like, he's entering a situation that is more dangerous on a daily basis than mine. And most mm-hmm. of his days, and I think, you know, I've had a police officer in my congregation, not here, who shot and killed a suspect. Mm-hmm. And I sat with him debriefing that experience, and he was never able to return to work.
Really?
In the same way. And so what is incumbent upon me as a Christian is to embrace Andy's experience, embrace my friend's experience, and say, when I look at a situation like Michael Brown, regardless of what anybody thinks of Darren Wilson, that Darren Wilson has a life experience that is completely different from mine. And if I am going to be the presence of a loving, generous, gracious God, then it is incumbent upon me to at least embrace that experience. That I may think, man, sure, like, I know plenty of cops who are kind of dirty. I mean, just what, 2 weeks ago, there were two police officers in Florida who were fired because it was revealed that they were in the KKK.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
So yeah, you're, and I read that. So,
you know, we had McLaren on. Actually, you hooked me up with the connection to Brian McLaren. So he was on a while ago, and we randomly started the conversation by talking about the Planet of the Apes movie that just come out that weekend, the Dawn of the whatever it's called. And he made the really interesting observation that that movie was in some ways different than a lot of movies because it tried to show the point that there were good and evil on both sides.
Yeah,
obviously you're talking about, you know, animals and humans in that one. But his point was it'd be easy to characterize one side as being all bad. But the point is, like, you know, the old line, like the line of good and evil does not run between us and them. It's down the middle of all of us.
Yeah.
And so there are good people on both sides of this issue, and especially with racial issues, just as much. But how do we not?
There are some bad actors in the judicial system. And there are some bad actors in the African-American community and in any community. There are some criminals. You know, I don't know if Michael Brown charged Darren Wilson. I don't know if Darren Wilson, just like I don't know with cereal, I don't know if his behavior was justifiable. And I won't know. And so instead of building an artifice in my heart and in my conversation with people that says I'm on this side of it, my call as a follower of Jesus is to embrace both sides and say, like, this is the kind of tragedy that we need to eliminate everything that contributed to it.
Mm-hmm.
And what troubled me in the Christian response was that there was such an immediate run to corners on everybody, you know, like,
yeah.
My conservative friends sided with the police, and it's almost as if the police are always right in every situation, though they wouldn't say that, and that may not be generous. I need to be more generous than that. And I had liberal friends who said the police are always wrong, and that may not be generous either. So, but to say, okay, this is the kind of tragedy, and whether it's fatherlessness in the African American community, whether it's rogue cops, whether it's racism, all of those things, it is the responsibility of Christians to speak into and to bring new creation to.
Yeah, but how,
not just to pick one.
Yeah, but how do we not get into this, like, dualistic, you know, us versus them thinking that seems to be just the most natural thing to do is just to pick a side. Obviously, you know, your experience, my experience, they're different. You know, your dad marched with Dr. King, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And My dad did not march with Dr. King. You know, my dad grew up in Dallas as a white guy, went to college, and, you know, had a very fortunate life. I mean, I was born into great opportunities, and I had resources in front of me as a middle-class person that I just took for granted. But it's easy for me to line up with the majority of my white friends who are police officers. Because I have far, like tons of white friends who are police officers. I have an aunt who's a police officer. She, a Hispanic aunt.
And that's the thing. The issue there is a lack of knowing one another. And this is the very point that I'm making. It's, you know, Christina Cleveland talks about this. Our friend Christina. I call her our friend because you've had her on the podcast and she mentioned me in a blog post. So that's enough to make her a friend.
Yeah, that's good enough. Yeah. You
know, she talks about this idea in her book about being cognitive misers. And so what that is, we gravitate to people who are most like us, not because we have a dislike for other people, but because it's just easier mentally and emotionally. Mm-hmm. And so you end up with people who share your same experience, and listening to those people constantly talk about, you know, just gives credence to those experiences. Well, you know, my dad did march with Dr. King. He also ended up getting, you know, a doctorate from the University of Mississippi, which put me as a adolescent in some different sorts of places. Like, education was always important to our family, and I went to ACU. You and I went to the same college. You know?
Yeah.
So I was there about 30 years before you were.
maybe a few years before, not 30.
So then I end up, you know, pastoring churches that are predominantly white, and having a number of police officers in those congregations. And I have never, matter of fact, the police officers I have known in my churches have been some of the most gentle people that I've ever known.
Mm-hmm.
Honest to God, most gentle people that I've ever known. And so when something does happen, I can't just say, man, look, all cops are bad. Like, I know that's not true.
Because you've seen it up close and personal. Yeah. So I had this conversation with a friend who's trying to say, I'm not racist just because I don't want my daughter to date a black guy. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's what racist is. If you say, I don't want my daughter to date someone because of the color of her skin, I'm pretty sure that's right in line with what we call racism.
Yeah.
And he goes, but no, I just don't want to. And you would too. It's like, dude, seriously, I don't want my daughter to date anyone. I don't care, you know, what ethnicity. I just, no one. I don't. Yeah. I just want them to all be with me. But so we had this conversation. And so
that's an incarnational failure. I mean, like, but it's a failure to understand the incarnation.
And so, and that's why I was trying to get him to understand. Is like, well, what about so-and-so's son? What about so-and-so's daughter? Okay. If that was their daughter who you know, who's a part of our church, who's in your small group, they are that ethnicity. Would you really be upset if it was that? Because you know the character of that family. You know what the dad's like. You know what the mom's like. And you know that's just a kid. It's not someone who's... But not everyone has that sort of up close and personal interaction with someone.
Yeah. And that's, there are lots of things that contribute to us not knowing one another.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have to continue to do that. I mean, when my closest and longest friend is Craig Martin, Dr. Craig Martin, he's on the faculty at Harding now.
Introduce him as Dr. Craig Martin?
I do now because he really hates elitism, and I have to tell him all the time, like, that's you, dude. How many people have a PhD in philosophy?
Sounds terrible. I'm kidding.
But there was a point where he was a high school basketball coach and teacher. And one of the things that he did, first things he did in the school where he worked, was to befriend the African-American staff. Because he wants to live in a intentional sort of way with people. And that's the kind of thing that it takes. I mean, I talked about this in that blog post you referenced earlier. Like, this isn't going to happen just by, you know, it's not going to fall out of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take people saying, oh, like, this divide that we see actually has to be bridged, and there's no magic that's going to occur to make it happen.
Yeah.
So we have to take intentional steps to get to know people who aren't like us, because that's what Jesus did. I, when the scriptures talk about Jesus knowing our every temptation, like one of those temptations is to segregate, divide, and classify people. Mm-hmm. And so if you really want to, you cannot call yourself, I don't think, a disciple of Jesus and live in monochromatic us versus them, that kind of world.
No.
Like, I think that's a failure to be the people of Jesus. And this is the one thing. Churches do a lot of good things and a lot of things that are kind of ridiculous, but we still do them. Mm-hmm. But I mean, like the Apostle Paul talks about in 2 Corinthians that this is what Jesus has given us, the ministry of reconciliation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so if your church is not doing that, your church is not doing the very ministry that scripture calls you to do.
Yeah. So one of the issues though is if you've got a person on stage who is spouting a specific political kind of line. And mm-hmm. so you've got a guy on stage and he's decided, okay, yeah, I need to talk about this. I need to talk about what goes on in Ferguson. And so I saw one, you know, big white church pastor, a Baptist-y church in Dallas, and his response was,
there are big Baptist-y white churches in Dallas?
That's weird. I know. I didn't know. And so like the pastor gets up there and he does a lot of like abortion's terrible. Okay. I get that. And then his next, you know, his other tweets are, you know, I hope America can respond better to the grand jury's verdict tonight than it has done else time or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so what he's really saying is, I hope black people don't protest when the grand jury comes down and gives them this verdict, right? And so you've got a guy who's speaking into the issue. He's telling the world what he thinks Christianity requires them to do, like to submit to their leaders. And in doing so, he's continuing that like Sunday morning divide, like that whole line that, you know, Sunday morning, 10 o'clock hour is the most racist and divided time in America, because he's speaking into it. And it seems almost that if you would refrain from talking about it too directly, you can create a more welcoming environment. But you don't think we should do that?
No. Well, I think the way, at least that I go about talking about things directly, is that I talk about my own struggle in pursuing Christ in that way. Like if your message is I don't think this is just generally true. If your message is always you people should, or those people should, I think you've missed what preaching is about anyway.
Yeah.
Because yeah, as the book of Acts puts it, like we speak of what we have seen and we have heard.
Mm-hmm.
So the preaching, at least in the book of Acts, comes from the experience of God, the life of God in the speaker, and trying to show that as a mirror sort of talking point, as Oprah used to say of her show, like she's trying to tell stories where people can see themselves inside that story.
Mm-hmm.
So like when I talk about Michael Brown and Ferguson, like I'm not saying those people ought to do this or you people ought to think this. I'm saying like this is where I potentially struggle with this,
yeah.
But this is what Jesus says and this is what I'm aiming for.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with what we hear too much of the church is, and this happens in all areas, is the whoever is speaking is setting themselves up as the idol of what everything should look like and what their opinions of whatever. So I don't ever give my opinions. I don't think we should about today's hot topics, because so many times you're wrong and you don't want your sermons should shape life and how to live life, and teaching should shape life and how to live life. They should not be built around the 24-hour news cycle.
Yeah.
So when I talk about Michael Brown, or when I, you know, talk about real expletive, as we were saying before, the idea there is saying this, what's going on today in the headlines is an illustration of the bigger thing that Jesus is calling us to. And we want to live inside that bigger thing. So when the next Michael Brown thing comes up, I won't want people to think, oh, I should be conservative on this, or I should be liberal on this, or I should even be down the middle. I want people to think, what's the Jesus response to this? So it's much more about helping people think theologically about working their way through life versus where you should come down on an issue.
Yeah, that's good. Did you read Jim Wallace's book from a few years back? I think the title was God's Politics.
Yes, I did. And I don't remember much of it, but I did.
Okay, so like and I haven't read it in a long time, so I'm just kind of riffing off what I remember from, you know, 8 years ago or 10 years ago when I read it. But the way I understood the book was he was trying to say, you know, God is not a Republican. Okay, uh-huh. Great. I think we can all should be able to get behind that. Not yeah. Everyone can, especially, you know, in my world, but God's not a Republican. God's bigger than that. But one of the things that it seems like has happened since that book came out is that you continue to see Jim Wallace and his group, Sojourners, and they get more and more aligned with the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like you say, well, okay, God's not a Republican, but then he does the exact same thing and says, well, now it seems like God is a Democrat.
A Democrat.
And so there are a lot of Christians who are Democrats. There are a lot of Christians who are Republicans. And that, like, teetering between one side and the other, it's not that easy because you see people constantly aligning their prophetic message that turns into a political message. And you mm-hmm. touched on this in your piece about it, that one of the reasons that we aren't that prophetic is because we become too political. And so yeah. we cash in our prophetic voice by just being another political mm-hmm. mouthpiece. And that's why I think, and this might just be the Anabaptist theology that I carry with me, but if you can get up on Sunday morning and preach in a way that people know your politics, you failed.
Yes.
Because yeah. you've succumbed and you've bowed down not to Jesus, but to the right or to the left. Mm-hmm. And if people can say, okay, oh, he's just spouting off his Republican or Democratic stuff, then what you've made is the politics the means for advancing the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, and there are a couple of things about that. And like I have the sign, I have a note actually on my desk that says that we have become a tool to the right, an enemy to the left, and prophetic to neither. And so it's not just big white Baptist churches in Dallas. I mean, just kind of all, if you just lump evangelicalism in together, that's what people think. And this is where you, me and our mutual friend, Scott McKnight, kind of part ways a little bit, because he has a specific definition for evangelical. And I said, well, that may be right, but that's not what people think when they hear evangelical. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, it doesn't really matter what people think. And I think the only thing that matters is what people think. Like when you hear a word, like what you think that word is the only thing that matters.
But yeah.
He's much smarter than I am, so I don't want to fight. But yeah, I don't think many people disagree with that.
Okay, but carry on.
One of the ways that all Christians can help that situation is, and I think I said this in the piece, is divorcing ourselves from that system, to just not participate in that system. This is, since we're in the season of Advent, this is the story of the wise men, right? So they kind of smell a rat that Herod doesn't really want to worship the baby Jesus, that he has other motives. And so as Matthew tells us, they go home by another way. And just holding out that idea, okay, there's a power out there that wants me to participate in something to some degree that is not in line with what Jesus is trying to do. So I'm just going to live another way. Mm-hmm. Ways that we can do that is most of us just need to turn off cable news, you know, talk radio, those affiliates that are designed to empower one side or the other. Mm-hmm. And because they're not trying to be fair, they're not trying to be gracious. They don't have the kingdom of God as an agenda item. And so we don't need to listen to those voices and allow those voices to infect how we think about things. Because there are churches, and you know this, where the pastor is being prophetic to both, is trying to convey a Jesus message. But because the congregation listens, they actually just trust Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh or Rachel Maddow, and Lawrence O'Donnell, they just trust those people more than they trust their actual pastor.
Wow, that's interesting. You really think it comes down to the issue of trust? Because I think you might be onto something.
I do. I think they actually trust those folks because it's more tangible. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's more tangible to say, this is the enemy, whatever side you think, and mm-hmm. we need to think these things and eliminate these people, than it is to say, okay, there's this way. That the fundamental way of Jesus is one of sacrifice.
Yeah.
And how do you do that in an American system where we all want certain things? We all want our kids to have a good life. We want to have a nice house, nice cars, comfort. And Jesus comes along and saying, hey, there's this whole laying down your life sort of thing. Yeah. There's this whole not getting your way sort of thing. If you were to actually imitate Jesus and be to offer your life as a sacrifice to the powers instead of trying to acquire power, then it looks a whole lot different and a whole lot more painful. And the church is the only voice in society saying that. The church, good churches, are the only voices in society saying it's not about winning. It's about living a discipled life. Yeah. But winning looks and feels a whole lot better.
Yeah, that's good. That's good stuff, man. Well, this has been helpful as always, Sean. We love having you on the show. It's always great to have you.
Thank you. I'm keeping my Richard Beck tally.
Yeah.
Sean Palmer tally going on.
Well, I feel like, you know, since you were the first, that should count as extra.
Do I get extra points for that?
Yeah, I think you should. I don't really know how that scoreboard looks, but it should.
Well, I don't know. It's not like being the first on the Tonight Show. First on the Tonight Show, you're like, we need a big opening and all that. And I think you kind of went into it thinking, I don't really know if this is going to work. So I don't, cash in too many chips.
You know, I actually recorded a couple practice ones and I just threw those away. And so you didn't get forced into doing that with, I think Stormont did one and Graves and Wade and who else? I definitely didn't see
Wade Hodges, Jonathan Stormont. We want to give people's full names because your podcast is so huge.
It's
now
massive.
That they don't know shorthand of people that we know.
Well, I'm slowly trying to condition people just to call them the names that I call them. We don't need their full name, just the abbreviated name.
But if you were going to mention Barbara Brown Taylor or some of the other,
I would just call her. Aunt Barb. I just call her Aunt Barb. Just Aunt Barb. That's all I call her.
I think she loves you, by the way.
I think she thinks I'm a stalker. That's like really
the second podcast you did with her. There was, I mean, I get it. The first time you don't know who you're talking to, and there's a little bit, there was very much like her talking to you, like you were just sort of her, like,
nephew,
cute grandson or something.
I was going to say nephew, but I appreciate you. I don't know why I had to throw the word cute in there, but thank you. She is outstanding. I've got a vision for some
project. I just got this vision that she was like very much looking forward to her time with Luke today.
Well, you know, it's just ridiculous that I seriously can call her up and say, hey, let's talk. And, okay, sure, let's do it. Like, I literally emailed her like 3 weeks before. Hey, let's talk. Okay, sure. What time? All right, good. Okay.
Yeah. She likes you. I can tell it. She likes you.
I think she thinks that I'm going to like call her every 3 months and ask her to talk to me. So I think she tried to say, it's good talking with you. I'll talk to you. Have a good life. So I think she thinks I'm going to show up outside of her like ranch down in Georgia and just try to like stay at her house sometime. But I probably won't do that.
Well, you know, everybody likes to be appreciated, mm-hmm. you know, and I think she likes I get the feeling she liked the idea that she doesn't have to show up or do. It's not like when she's on Oprah, yeah. where there's a whole to do about it, and she just feels comfortable and she talks about her work to people, someone that she's comfortable with, to an audience that's appreciative of it. And, you know,
did you hear her say that she's not going to watch her episode on Oprah? She said she never has. Yeah. She isn't going to do it, which blows my mind.
I wouldn't either.
Seriously, you wouldn't?
I totally get that. Yeah.
Why wouldn't you do it?
Oh, well, one, I hate the sound of my own voice. Like, it takes me a week to listen back through one sermon because I can only listen to, like, 5 minutes at a time. Mm-hmm. And, like, I just don't think that I could muster up the courage to be able to do that. You don't know how much energy it takes me to just read back through something that I wrote at some point. There's a weird vulnerability there that I don't get and I don't try to explain or make to seem right. It's just very hard. So if should Oprah call me, I'll be more than glad to go on the show, but I doubt that I would watch it. But I certainly would tell everyone that I've ever met that I would be on.
Oh, trust me. We know you. We know you would have it on there just as I would do the exact same thing.
But the best part about that was when she said it's on at 11 o'clock on Sunday. And I thought that was so great, like that, because you know me well enough that I just have this commitment to the local church. And one of the things I love about her is that she does too. This idea, I thought it was just beautiful, this idea that she had about these are the people who have chosen to gather today. And you and I, in the kind of church work we do,
we get it.
We are so appreciative of that. Like, like you bothered to show up today. Yeah.
It's crazy how much she cares about that. Cause you would think someone with her notoriety and her level of success, you know, obviously someone that Oprah wants to have her on her show, that she could just do her thing and it wouldn't matter, but she really has this bond with her listeners. Like, it's not just people she's talking blank faces, but it seems like they're actual people. And that seems so foreign in like this, you know, mega church, you know, preachers all over screens, not knowing their people, spending all their time in green rooms, kind of understanding of church, that she just doesn't want anything to do with that.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, I don't know the proper way to characterize what a mega church pastor is like. But there's something to me about this idea of this is a sermon that is designed for this group of people to hear about life in the way of Jesus. And so much of, I think, I don't want to think too highly of it. I think so many of my sermons don't translate outside of our context.
You think so?
Outside of my context.
Okay. Now you've preached for me though. Like, you preach a sermon for me. You took it probably out of your file, which I hope you did. I think I encourage you to recycle something so you did take the summer, you know, a Sunday and a summer off. But you came, you preached at our church, and it was a good sermon. But you think it would have landed better with your people than it would?
It did land better with my people.
Oh.
And it was a sermon about, at the heart of it, of what it is to be this local community that is trying to be a different kind of community in their context.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought it fit your congregation well because they're similar in some ways. The tradition we come out of, the traditions in that tradition that we're trying to hold on to and the ones that we're letting go of, I thought it fit well. But it, you know, it was a... I would give that sermon, when I gave it here, an A. I would give it a C+, the one I did for you.
Yeah, that's what I would give it to.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. No. But I hear what you're saying. Like, next Sunday, I'm taking a sermon that I did at my church. I'm preaching it somewhere at a friend's church down in Dallas. And
big white Baptist. White.
Right. I mean, basically, yes. but I'll be interested to see the difference in how it lands there compared to where it lands here. I think the biggest thing of getting up and preaching in which you know everyone and you're not having to win people over. You know, I heard Seinfeld talk about, like, as a stand-up, now that he has notoriety, they give him the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And, like, they're going to laugh anything he says because it's Jerry Seinfeld for the first 5 minutes. But after that, he's got to win the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And I love getting up knowing that, honestly, I've got
to win the crowd.
I don't I don't have to win the crowd. Like, I don't think he's like for 5 minutes. I have 25 minutes. Like, I have the whole, I could do a complete bomb and my people still care about me and they're going to go, all right, whatever. We're still going to listen. But they might be checking their phone throughout the sermon, but at a different audience, different crowd, you don't know them. You're having to build that rapport. And there's something about preaching that it's better in relationships. I get that.
Yeah. And so I think that's beautiful. I don't have anything against mega churches. I think they serve a purpose. I do think in our moment in history, there's been a real loss of the community church, not in the big, like, such and such community church, but a church that is designed to live in and serve this community. And without all the market research, without all the targeting, to say that we believe that this community, that God's given us this community in a certain way, and we're going to love and serve it. And the folks who gather here care deeply for one another and deeply for our world. That's not everything that there is to church, but I think it's certainly something that's been lost in church. And I just may be real romantic about it because I grew up as a kid in Mississippi at a small local church plant that maybe got a little bit over 100 people, but it was the most racially diverse church I've ever been in. And that's Mississippi in the early 80s. Like, those people loved me and taught me scripture in a way that no one else has since that time. So I may just be romanticizing that experience, but I think there's a place for that that's valuable, that in our big, huge catalyst, 10,000 people, 20,000 people church, let's strive to be bigger, faster, slicker, that's really lost, that says there's something at the heart of this that isn't about production, but about the experience and lives and knowing the lives of people. Like, so this afternoon, like, I'm just doing rounds. Like, I'm going to pack up my computer, get in the car, and I'm driving to visit everybody in our church who is sick, you know, in their house. Hmm. There's something.
I'm too much of a germaphobe to do that. It grosses me out, man. But there's something about a pastor who does that.
I have this other belief, too, that whenever you're exposed, it's totally non-scientific, but I think whenever you're exposed to something you can get sick from, that if you're there in the service of ministry, you won't. I know that. I know that Kent Brantley is the reason.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I think Kent might have something to say about that.
I wouldn't do that with Ebola. But I've been in hospital rooms where it's like, okay, I'll. But I said, this is in the service of Jesus, so I'll be okay.
Yeah, that's a difference in you having like one biology class in undergrad and Ken actually being a medical doctor. He actually understands what he's getting into.
Like I said, it's not logical but it's...
Hey, let me tell you something. I never let logic or reason get in the way of a good point. And I appreciate your commitment to do that as well.
But it's more like not letting logic and reason get in the way of doing the Jesus thing. So
blah, blah, blah.
And which Kent would agree with because he's not Ann Coulter.
No. Oh, we love Kent. Oh, it's great to say that.
Were you in school with him?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you guys were after me. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah, he was there the same time I was there. And, you know, for some reason he hasn't come on the podcast, I guess talking to the president in Congress and Matt Lauer is more important than me, but, I'm not bitter.
Yeah. As do many people, huge respect because that's not something that he had to do, you know. No. And you and I have both went to school with people who became doctors so that they could have a big house in downtown Dallas. And, yeah. You know, when people don't do that, when say, no, like, we actually do care about the world, that's the best of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And yeah. so he represents that. So more power to him. And he did, you know.
He's done great with the way he's communicated his message after that. And I mean, everything that I've heard him say, I'm like, wow, I'm super impressed with you. So we're proud to have him a part of the old church. So Sean, it's been fun as
Good
always.
To talk to you again.
All right, man. Thanks, man.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.